Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, thanks for coming along tonight, folks, for Helen Trinker making her third appearance at the Sydney Institute. Helen's been here for earlier books, Better Than Sex, How a Whole Generation Got Hooked on Work, was one of them. And of course the other one, Waterfront, The Battle That Changed Australia, where she spoke with Anne Davies, and we got Chris Corrigan along as well. But today, Helen Trinker's here on the occasion of the launch of her first biography, Madeleine, A Life of Madeleine St. John. And Janet Grundy's got some copies of that if anyone wants it after. Now I should briefly introduce Helen Trinker beyond that to say that she has held senior reporting and editing roles in Australian journalism, including a stint as the Australian's London correspondent. And Helen Trinker is currently managing editor of The Australian, and she's going to talk at the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic Searching for Madeleine St. John, The Craft of Biography. Helen Trinker, thank you very much.
Thank you, and good evening, everyone. Small but perfectly formed crowd, and you'll be asked questions afterwards. It'll be like book club. When Anne and I agreed on the date of this address, we also settled on this title, The Craft of Biography. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, but lately, as I've actually been working on the speech, I wonder whether I should throw away that title and then substitute it with another, which is really Edward St. John, Man of Principle or Monster, or both, because indeed that's the question that dominated this book about Madeleine St. John, Ted St. John's daughter, and which caused me to bring to bear all my skills, really, that I could muster for this craft of biography. And it was a craft that I found myself practising somewhat accidentally these past couple of years, so more of that later. But I think for this audience here tonight, without necessarily suggesting an age range, it might be a particularly interesting question to ask about Ted St. John, because many of you would know and remember Ted, as I did it from a distance. Ted was, of course, a Liberal member for Warringah, that's Tony Abbott's seat, from 1966 to 1969. And he was the backbencher who became notorious for his decision to publicly stand up and criticise, first one Prime Minister, Harold Holt, and then the behaviour of another Prime Minister, his own Prime Minister, of course, on both occasions, John Gorton. So Ted was somebody who was very much in my headspace when I was a teenager at 16 in Perth in 1966, because partly I think the pronunciation of his name, we had to learn that it was not, you know, silly old St. John, but St. John, and so it stuck, I guess. But also because even in our household, which was not a Liberal household particularly, he was seen as very much a man of principle, a maverick who'd stood up to the Liberal Party and to his bosses on matters of principle. So he was indeed a man of principle and a man, a public figure, not just in the 60s, but later as a barrister, as a conservationist, and surprisingly to some, I suppose, as a nuclear disarmament campaigner. He was very much the picture of a man of public action, and he had a reputation. That reputation, he cherished that reputation, but it was one that was challenged absolutely by his daughters, Madeleine, and who's the subject of my biography, and her younger sister, Colette, who was 3 years younger. They had a very different view. Now, I suppose that's not that surprising that children, even though as they grow into the teenage years, might think that their parents are rubbish. But for these St. John daughters, the anger with their father, their sadness, their disappointment, never really went away. And Madeleine St. John clung to that image and to those memories. She told a lot of people over the course of her life, both here in Australia and then later, the years that she lived in London, she told a lot of them about this father who'd rejected her, that the father who'd emotionally abandoned her and Colette as young children. But she could never, of course, demolish the public reputation of her father. In some senses, she always felt nobody really listened. There were camps within the St. John family. The cousins, some cousins went one way, some the other. Various views amongst her friends, but these were ultimately private, hidden judgments and conversations. And so to the outside world, Ted St. John seemed a model citizen and a man who made a significant contribution, even if people like the veteran press gallery reporter Alan Reid thought him a man who lacked political sense, and I think he wasn't alone in that. I just want to read you, it's a slight digression, but it's such wonderful writing from Alan Reid, who in his own biography, not a biography, rather his history of the Gorton years, called The Gorton Experiment. You don't get writing like this about politicians anymore. This is what he said about Ted St. John, who of course had just responsible for this giant upheaval around Gorton, and he, you know, Ted stood up in Parliament and said how, you know, effectively, you know, was suggesting that Gorton was a playboy and not fit for office. And Alan Reid said in this, in his book of Ted St. John, austere and rigorous, humble of mien but arrogant of mind, as convivial as a shrouded side of beef hanging in a chilling chamber. I thought, I've got to work that into every speech I ever make about this book because it's just too good. So that was Ted St. John. Anyway, to move on a little, it was only in 1997 when Madeline, then aged 55, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for her third novel called The Essence of the Thing. It was only then that some references to the slightly dysfunctional relationship that seemed to exist between father and daughter surfaced in the press. By now, Ted St. John had died in a couple of years earlier. Madeline's anger, however, was as vital as it had ever been, and some of this complex emotional story did emerge, but it faded very quickly. In the end, Madeline felt she'd got absolutely no satisfaction. She continued to rant to friends about the public and private disconnect that she felt. I think she felt somehow that she'd been cheated. She'd never been able to convince anyone really about this person who she termed in a letter at one point, the ghastly Ted. By 2004, when she was in her early 60s, Madeline knew her time was running out. She had by then, she was living in London, she'd written her four books had been published. She had not won the Booker Prize, but she was fairly happy about everything, but she had very severe emphysema. She knew she couldn't live much longer. And so it was, as I said, a good time in her life, but the only thing that really seemed to matter to her at the end was that the truth be told about her father and about her childhood. His public record was intact. Madeline blamed him, though, for most of what had gone wrong in her life, and she wanted her version put down. I think she didn't want Ted to somehow get away with it. So she put it all down on tape. She had 9 hours of statements about the father, who she thought was one thing in public and another at home, and she asked her friend Judith McHugh to write the biography based on those tapes. A couple of years later, Madeline died. The tapes were, in a sense, too, more or less dead, because Judith had no real interest in writing the biography. And in 2011, when I happened upon the scene, by chance, absolutely, there they were. I found Judith in Chicago at that stage, and the tapes were in a box. She told me about them, and then I actually had a lot more to go on in this biography that I had already begun to write. So, in a way, I suppose the point about trying to tell you all that is that, in a way, this story, which is about Madeline's story, which hadn't been told before, but also Ted's story, in a sense, which hadn't been told before, is being told. Now, this is not the public story of Ted St. John, and I'm not suggesting that all of the public record is wrong, or even all the private record that Madeline suggests is correct. You won't find a great deal in this book about Ted St. John MP or Ted St. John QC. It's Ted's private life that's discussed and debated, and it's a story that, of necessity, that private life, that is filtered through Madeline's memories of it. But I think, in a sense, it does bring me back to the original title of this talk, because clearly I did spend a lot of time trying to work out whether he was the man of principle or the monster, who, quite literally, the monster that she thought he was. To that end, I had to do quite a lot of exercise of this craft of biography. So people talk about the art of biography, but this is, as Jared said, my first biography, and I feel more comfortable talking about the craft because in the beginning and ultimately too, I'm basically a reporter, and it was my skills in training in journalism, not in biography as such, that I brought to this project. I think they turned out to be skills that were very good for this particular book because I think I did well, in a sense, at the research in this book because there was very little material around at first and I really had to trawl for it. When it came to the writing, I think I learned an enormous amount from the process because I was used to writing articles for magazines or parts of the paper that might be 3,000 words long. And I thought I knew something about the writing of a story, but when you come to manage the narrative of a person's life over 90,000 or 100,000 words, you have to exercise a completely different approach. And as I said, that's added to the you add that to the process of actually trying to find the material. The search for Madeline was pretty challenging because she was unknown. Now, I was attracted to her because she was unknown, because the invisibility of Madeline and the lack of knowledge made me curious. I think that it's boring, learning about people that you know about and trawling over the facts that you already know. So I was very engaged, in a sense, by the detective work around it. And I was curious, too, because she's an expat writer who seemed to have slipped through the cracks. She had gone to London at the end of the 60s and stayed there, but had not been a professional Australian. We were very familiar with Clive and Jermaine and Barry, but when I started talking about this, my friend said, "Madeline who?" I was keen to do it, and I didn't mind the fact that she was under the radar, because there's a lot of opportunity to discover people that, who, in a sense, aren't known. But this lack of a public life was a challenge. Ted had the public life, she didn't, and so in a sense I was looking for his private life and more on her public life in a way and what she'd actually done. I'll give you a little quick synopsis here. Might not be the right spot to do it, but I'm about to do it now, of what actually we know about her, just very quickly. She was born Madeline in Sydney in 1941, so she would, if she were alive today, be about 72. She was a classic wartime baby in the sense that Ted had joined the AIF before she was born, and he met her for the first time when she was 15 months old and he came back from Palestine. Her mother, Sylvette, was a French émigré, and after the war, when they were reunited all again, the St. Johns lived in various houses around Sydney, winding up at number 9, the Rampart in Castle Craig, where really it was in that house where the tragedy of her life really emerged, because it was there in 1954 that Sylvette committed suicide. And that shattered the lives of Ted, of Madeline, and of course of Colette. And those shattered lives, especially the shattered life of Madeleine, are at the centre of this book. She went to Sydney University after school. She married. She separated from her husband, Chris Tillam, after a few short years of marriage when they were both living in America. And she went to London in the beginning of January 1968, and she lived there until her death. She lived in near poverty. She struggled at times with depression, and despite her sort of sparkling manner and a great capacity for charm, there were difficult times. Then suddenly, in 1993, she published a lovely little novel, The Women in Black, and there are copies out there. That's the only one of her four novels set in Australia. Many of you might have read it. It's sort of a fictional version of life at David Jones, and that might sound rather superficial, but of course she tackles in at some quite deep subjects about Australia at a certain point in the 60s or late 50s, the turning point from a kind of a Anglo-Saxon Australia to a multicultural Australia, even though she never mentions that word, and it's set at a time long before it was ever mentioned. She wrote then three novels, and they're all set in Notting Hill, in a little tiny, well, not exactly Notting Hill, but around the inner London, and it's a very tiny territory. Again, quite deep ideas, but small in their scope. She was nominated, as I said, in 1997 for the Booker, but Australia claimed her at that point and sort of colonised her, and we loved her for a while there. But then when Arundhati Roy won the Booker that year for The God of Small Things, Australia rather promptly forgot about the novelist with this sort of snooty name. And by the time she died in 2006, she wasn't scarcely known really here or in London. I stumbled upon them, her and her books, when I happened to read a novel of hers at the beginning of 2011. And I was fascinated. I sort of jumped onto Google and found out some of those bare bones of her life. I thought she, from the book I read, that she was unbelievably English, quintessentially English, middle class, wife of a professional, holidays in France, that sort of thing. But of course, when you discover that she's lived a single life, she's an expat, she had no children, and she lived in poverty, it's sort of intriguing how she wrote about a different world. So I suppose, as I went into it, I tried to understand, too, what had happened, what had gone wrong, because Clive James, when her books were published, started saying that she was a the brightest light of their generation. They'd all been at university together around the same time and worked on L'Histoire. He hadn't particularly noticed Madeleine in those early years. When she was published, he said, you know, our claim to fame will be that we once knew her, you know, which is perhaps an overstatement on Clive's part, but equally so, he saw a lot of her. But what was interesting to me was quite what had gone wrong in that sense that she took so long. You know, she was in her 50s before she published these books, and it was a very brief period when she shone. And, you know, you look back and you think, was it gender? Certainly at Sydney University, it was an era when the men, and they admit this themselves, made the decisions, and the women thought that they should make the decisions as well. They would be the ones who actually had the voice, you know. It was assumed, I suppose, that they would be the dominant voice. And again, in London, in the 60s and the 70s, I suppose it was actually still a period when it was might have been pretty hard for women to have cut through, although clearly Germaine did, well and truly. But it was a factor. But there are obviously some other problems for Madeleine, and I've referred, in a sense, to the biggest one of all, which was her personal personal sort of challenge that she faced all her life in trying to work out that relationship with her father and come to terms with it, which is something really, in essence, I think she never really did. Anyway, just very quickly about some of the research, you know, and the lack of material. She'd really gone out of her way, Madeleine, to cut out most of anything, you know, to leave a very small footprint on the planet, and she'd winnowed down her friends and relations to about three people at the end. She had a contact book that she'd washed of all her old contacts, and there are about six numbers in it, including the local Chinese takeaway and the vet for her beloved cat. And her work was good, but it was very small. That's four novels only. Nothing else. There is one unpublished novel, which I've read, and it's probably her agent and publisher and literary executive, Bruce Beresford, thought, don't think it's worth publishing. I think it probably will be at some stage. It'll get out somewhere, because if you love her work, you'll want to read even that book. But it's a small body of work, so, you know, where do you start when there's no archive, very little public record, no diaries, and really no letters? But of course, you always do find things, and so I found some friends and relations, and I found others. They knew others. I found letters. You know, everyone had a couple of letters here and there from different decades. I found a stash of photographs that she'd sent to someone, and of course, the tapes that I've just mentioned. So, you know, bit by bit, I began to put it together. And because she had died relatively young, at the age of 64, there are a lot of very alert 70-year-olds who were her contemporaries, and I was lucky to find even a couple of older people who had known Sylvette, and that was really one of the challenges, to find people who had known Sylvette, who died in 1954, you know, Madeleine's mother, and to have got some sense of what she was like, because that was so difficult. Everyone would talk to me about Ted. Everyone talked to me about Ted's second wife, Val, you know, and but no, few people had a sense of what Sylvette was like. So I've never seen myself as an investigative journalist in my day job, but I think in the 2 years I researched this book, I used exactly the sort of skills of an investigative journalist, even though this is a very domestic story, it's not a big political story. But I think, you know, persistence, lateral thinking, energy, the attention to detail, and the sort of imaginative leaps I think you need to make if you're going to pull the pieces together, I certainly exercised. I've been criticised by one reviewer, the novelist Michelle Decretz, for not writing a literary biography. I think I would have fallen flat on my face if I'd attempted that, because I'm not an academic. I've got a BA in English Lit from about 1968 or something, but I don't have the skills for academic analysis of Madeleine's work, and so I didn't attempt that. And I'm also sure, too, that an academic, even the best academic, and very many professional biographers would not have been able to do what I did in finding Madeleine, because the particular search for Madeleine ended up being a search that a journalist was actually equipped to do. So I was pretty dogged in my pursuit of her, and I think it's paid off. But it is one thing to pull in the data. You have to know what to do with it. It has to add up to something. It has to have a point. And to that point, I just wanted to mention a very quick comment from a great American historian and biographer, David McCulloch. And when I finished the book and had time to read again, I actually read an old interview that he'd done in the Paris Review, online, of course. And he has this... it's great in this question of, you know, what you do with material. He talked about a motto which he has hanging over his desk, and I'll quote him. This is McCulloch's voice here. It says, "Look at your fish." It's a test that Louis Agassiz, the 19th century Harvard naturalist, I think it's Agassiz, but I'm not quite sure of the pronunciation. It's a test that he gave every new student. He'd take an odorous old fish out of a jar, set it in a tin pan in front of the student and say, "Look at your fish." Then Agassiz would leave. When he came back, he'd ask the student what he'd seen. "Not very much," they would most often say, and Agassiz would say it again, "Look at your fish." This could go on for days. The student would be encouraged to draw the fish but couldn't use any tools for examination. And McCulloch goes on, "Samuel Scudder, who later became a famous entomologist and expert on grasshoppers, left us the best account of this ordeal with the fish. After several days, he couldn't see whatever it was that Agassiz wanted him to see. Then he had a brainstorm, and he announced it to Agassiz the next morning, paired organs on this fish, the same on both sides. Of course," Agassiz said, very pleased. So Scudder naturally asked what to do next, and Agassiz said, "Look at your fish." So I think it's a wonderful story, and McCulloch says, you know, the insight comes most often from looking hard at the material that's already on the table. You often don't find anything particularly new. It's what you do with it and what you see in it. And he says, seeing is as much the job of an historian as it is of a poet or a painter. So I was discovering quite a lot of new things about Madeline and putting them on the table, things that hadn't been discovered before, but I still needed to see what they meant. And of course, one of the things I suppose that I am aware of is how much I love the little bits of information that you can get, and what I can see in those is sometimes more than in the big bits. So a lot of people who I interviewed would begin by saying they knew nothing much about Madeline, they couldn't help me a great deal. And then, of course, they'd go on to talk about her life, and I'd stay in there sort of pouncing upon the diamonds that they revealed. I'll just give an example. She had an old school friend, Des Hunter. They were at school together at St. Catherine's Boarding School in Waverley when they were 13, from about 13 to 15. And Des, who's a wonderful woman who I discovered late in the piece, said to me that Madeline had never had any food in her tuck tin. That's a phrase I had never heard before, but I knew exactly what it was, of course. It's the tuck box or the tuck tin that the boarders would have where they were allowed to put their food that when they came back from being out with their parents and whatever, to sort of add to the normal rations of boarding school life, you know, the cake and the apples and things. So Des's mother would send down lots of beautiful boxes of Granny Smiths from their home up in Cessnock, and she sent down all this sort of lovely stuff to her beloved child. But Madeline, who was motherless by now, came back from Saturdays at home at Castle Craig with not very much to show for it. She never had anything in her tuck tin. And I thought that was incredibly sad. And it's just one of those little poignant memories. And there's Des Hunter, you know, what is it, 60 years later anyway, from a long time later, talking to me about this person that she knew at school. And the thing that she remembered was this very poignant detail about the sort of lack of care, I suppose, that was being no one's fault particularly, not Ted's fault probably, no one's fault, but that Madeline didn't have any food in her tuck tin. So I love stories like that, and this book is full of those because I think it adds a lot to the total story. I took a decision, in a sense, not to make too many big claims in the book and to actually let readers see the paired organs of the fish and to help them to discover things rather than stating it strongly. Another little example that I think this audience of predominantly women might really connect with. Des again said to me that on Saturdays, when she'd often go home with Madeline to their house, because on Saturdays you could go home from boarding school for the day, you didn't,
so
and you had to go back.
What boarding school is
St. Catherine's again at Waverley.
Right.
Yeah, and you could go home for the Saturday. So Des would often go home with Madeline. Ted would pick them up, drive them back to Castle Craig in the car, and Ted. Sylvette, the mother, was, I think, at that stage either in hospital, you know, because she was having psychiatric issues, or she may have even been dead by then, but whatever the period of time was, it was around then. And Ted had organised for one of his friends, a woman friend, to come to the house to care for the children for the day. So Ted would drop them off and then go off. You know, he would not go into the house, he wouldn't spend time with them. They'd go and have dinner with an aunt around the corner, and then Ted would come back, I guess, and take them back to boarding school by 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And, you know, when Des told me that, it was just a sort of throwaway line, but when you think about it, it says enormous amounts, not particularly for her at that stage, because she was without a mother, really, in essence, but also about the time, you know, around the period. You know, Ted, like most men of that generation, wouldn't have had any belief that he had to connect to his children, particularly not connect to his daughters, I suppose, and the idea that he would go into the house, spend time with them at all on a Saturday, because after all, he would have much more important things to do. You know, he would have to go to golf, and he might have to go and talk to other people, and he might have to go back to the office and do work, but whatever, it was not man's work. So I suppose those are put, you know, those are the sorts of things that really add to the sort of social history that's part of this book. I might skip a couple of things because how am I going for time? Conscious of it? Anyway. A little bit more. I think one area that I do think is worth thinking about for a minute is, you know, you spend a lot of your time in a biography managing the living. You know, I mean, my subject was deceased, and that's, you know, probably a lot of biographies are of people who are dead, but the people who are alive often have quite a strong vested interest in a lot of elements of the story, and they also don't relish their own lives being invaded just simply because they happen to know someone at a particular time, and biography is very invasive. Two people in particular that I had to deal with and were Madeline's sister, Colette, and Madeline's former husband, Chris Tillam. Neither of them wanted to speak to me at first, and I could understand that. So I'd completed the first draft and was sort of 18 months into it all when they suddenly changed their minds in June of last year and agreed to talk to me. And I was immensely grateful to them, that it was a tremendously fruitful exercise with both of them. I didn't mind having to rewrite the entire book, but it it's a much better book, clearly. But negotiating my way through some of those family memories and vested interests and protective friends can be daunting at times. And there's also this issue of how much of their lives to put into the portrait. And I made quite a conscious decision with my editor to focus very much on Madeline because, you know, in that first draft, really, I'd probably gone off on all the side stories far too much because they are fascinating. It's very hard not to go on talking about the tucked in and all of those other things on the side and the people involved. And everyone's got an amazing story to tell. So I put a lot of that out. And we focused a lot more on Madeleine as a central character and, of course, on Ted. And that was the major issue, always juggling Ted and Madeleine. I'd heard the stories of the dysfunctional relationship, clearly, Madeleine had never made any secret of it. But it was only when I listened to the tapes that Madeleine had made, and I listened to those in Chicago in about May of 2011, as I listened to those, I really understood and appreciated the depth of her anger. She talks at length on those tapes about the emotional abuse from her father. There is a reference to one devastating incident when Ted hit her quite violently, but physical violence doesn't feature in those tapes apart from that incident. And it was a psychological and emotional abuse that in Madeleine's eyes was the damaging element, and she believed it to be deliberate. She truly did believe that Ted set out to hurt and harm her. So the problem that I had after I'd listened to 9 hours of these tapes, which are fairly extreme about Ted's motivation, she makes extreme claims about his motivation for any behaviour. And so there's a major problem that I faced was what weight to give to those tapes. Even her close friends cautioned me that Madeleine had been, in a sense, obsessed with the childhood, never been able to move beyond it. Some friends believe she was a fantasist. Others felt that she was accurately reflecting what had happened. So I faced really that dilemma about how I could be fair to Ted, fair to her, and, you know, whether I was going to be fair to either in the end. Of course, in the end, if you are going to do this sort of thing, you've got to make a choice. So they are imperfect, those choices, and the selections aren't ever absolute, but you are constructing a life, and you have to have a bit of clarity about what's going on. So even though I didn't shout out from the beginning of this book, I did take the view in the end that Madeleine was indeed a difficult woman, but she was also irresistible, brilliant, charming, and a pretty special person who'd survived and prevailed against herself, really, against her demons and against the tragedy of her childhood. She wasn't a sympathetic character, but she wasn't a shallow character. So in a sense, I suppose, I did stay with her. A lot of people have asked me whether I ended up hating her at the end of it, or, you know, would I have liked her if I'd ever met her? And I'm not sure whether I would have liked her if I'd met her, but I didn't mind her throughout the book. I still could understand her, I think, and I felt connected to her. It wasn't a zero-sum game, because even though Ted might be depicted as a monster as far as she's concerned, he's so like Madeline, really, or he was so like Madeline, that it's any wonder that they clashed. He could be as cruel and judgmental as she was, but he was also a smart, well-read, and a man of considerable depth, obviously. And really, to many people, he was as charismatic as his daughter, even if as narcissistic and pompous at times. So the challenge I faced, though, that I had a lot of material from Madeline about Ted, but not very much from Ted about Madeline. She convicted him on the tapes, well and truly convicted him on the tapes, but Ted, in a sense, delivered his verdict on her by almost sort of cutting her out of his record. So the public record, there's virtually no reference to her. There's very little. There are a lot of letters that have obviously been destroyed, of, you know, vitriolic letters, sadly, between Ted and her, and between Valerie, the stepmother, and her. But Ted really doesn't have a lot. There wasn't a lot on the record about Ted's view of Madeleine. One very quick one I'll tell you that is in the book is one of his when Ted died, there were condolences in Parliament. So he'd been out of Parliament for about 30 years, but of course the condolence motion was still there. So Don Derby, who'd shared a backbencher office with him at Old Parliament House in the period when Ted was in Parliament, stood up and said, oh, you know, Ted had a very tough life and everything because he had three disabled children, which is a devastating statement, because in fact he did have one disabled child, and that is sadly the son of Valen from his second marriage, who is intellectually disabled. But he had lumped his daughters, Madeline and Colette, in the 60s when he was talking to Don Doby, you know, in the office about them. He lumped them all under the same label of disabled. And Madeline read that comment and challenged Don Doby in a letter. And, when I found all that, she actually kept those papers. They were among the very few papers that she kept and intended to be kept by Judith for the biography. So that was a very, very, you know, devastating moment for her. Anyway, in the end, I suppose you have to say that Ted and she were not meant to have a happy life together. They really did clash. I attempted this minefield in some ways, and picking my way through the various versions of people's views about them is what I've managed to try to do in the book. I just want to give you a couple of other quick examples, and I will wind up, about what's important and what isn't. One of the best little bits of gossip in the book, really, is from Margaret Whitlam, the late Margaret Whitlam, of course, because I interviewed her a couple of times on the telephone, and she and Gough had been very close friends of Ted, because Gough and Ted had been at university together at law school, and then they'd been article clerks together, and so they all knew each other in that period around the early 40s and during the war. And when I was talking to Margaret about it, and of course Margaret and Gough had very little time for Ted St. John towards the end of their life, because Ted came out in the around the time of the dismissal, I think, and basically sort of piled on a particular newspaper article, piled a lot of, negativity upon Gough. So there's no love lost there in the end. But Margaret said to me, out of the blue, that she felt that Ted had always felt guilty about Sylvette's suicide because he'd been having affairs. And it was the first time I'd ever heard about this, and I thought, how would she know, and was it true, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, one way or the other, I sort of agonised over that, and nobody else ever thought that there had been an affair. I decided I'd put it in anyway because it was too good to leave out, and it might have been true. But then, in fact, I felt much more secure about leaving it all in, because eventually, towards the end of the process of the book, after Colette talked to me, Colette allowed me to have access to her mother's at Sylvette's psychiatric records, because Sylvette had been admitted to a public mental hospital a couple of times in the 50s before she suicided. And those records are not very large, but they make it very clear that Sylvette absolutely believed that Ted had had an affair, and at least a couple of affairs. The psychiatrist at the time and the profession at the time said, what a load of rubbish, this woman's delusional, of course he's not having an affair. And I think that's perhaps he's even correct, but in the end it's not so important really whether Ted had an affair or not, but the fact that Sylvette obviously thought he'd had an affair and it was very destructive to her mental health. It all seems easier now when I look back on it and sort of cut and dried, and when you're in the middle of these things, of course, as any other biographers in the room would know, you're agonised about it all. I guess the biggest lesson I learnt from it all is that biography is a very imperfect exercise. You can spend a lot of time trying to establish the smallest fact and then wonder whether you've actually missed the truth by discovering the fact. So it's a fascinating exercise that I loved and I learnt a lot from. I'm going to mention two quick emails that I got after the event to show you how this story, they never die, I think. I didn't really anticipate that people would keep on coming up with more information after the event, but of course you discover people that you haven't talked to. One of her friends wrote to me from London. I had never heard of this woman, and obviously a friend of a friend sent her the book, and she wrote me a note and said they'd all known each other in the 70s in London, and Madeline used to babysit for them, for her and husband and the kids, and that Madeline had an affair with a married journalist, which was all very delicious. And I thought, oh, well, I have to put that in the movie because it's certainly too late for the book. A more important one, perhaps, from another friend of hers at Queenwood, again, who I didn't know existed. And this woman said that she's living at Bathurst now, and she said she'd shared homework with Madeline a lot when they're year 11 and their leaving year. And she spent a lot of time at the St. John household. They'd done each other's homework, etc. Madeline was very bright and loved at that point. This woman said that Madeline had adored Ted at that moment. She was mad about him and deeply possessive, and that she felt that Valerie, this is Madeline, felt that Valerie threatened that relationship, threatened that love, and she turned on Valerie. Easy to see, I suppose, then how it turned on Ted rejecting her years later. You know, the years as the years go on, Madeline's version of that becomes a rejection by Ted of her. Now, it all seems very obvious, of course, but no one had actually said it to me in quite that way. And he was a very close friend who'd lived through it with Madeline at the same age. Much more accurate than Colette's version of what had happened, to be honest, or what the motivation or what had gone on. Much more accurate than the cousins who lived down the road, or the aunts and uncles who lived down the road. Much more accurate than the version that Madeline herself actually told at the end of her life. And yet, of course, far too late for the book. So I suppose what I learnt from all of that was that one needs to be humble in the face of another person's life, because there's very the difficulty, I suppose, of capturing it, and feeling that you can actually capture another person's life is quite profound. But anyway, if you want to read about the effort that I made, it's all in the book. So thank you.
Thanks.
As I said, Janet Grundy's got some copies of Madeline, A Life of Madeline St. John by Helen Trinker. So we'll come to questions and discussion. We've got till 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. Okay. So,
anyone?
I don't know, I'm running this. I'm completely in charge. Yeah, so totally in charge. As a new biographer, I mean, is it possible these days to write a history of someone who's prominent, who doesn't have a traumatic problem either with their parents or with their school? I mean, everyone seems to be traumatised. Madeline ended up liking a cat, and possibly a married man. We don't know about that. But, I mean, it does seem to me these days the world is full of people who are so traumatised they can't get over it. And how much did it affect her? I mean, do you think she had a happy life, or was she just happy hating her father? I mean, what was going on there?
Well,
you come back here.
I'll come back here. I think I'll just sort of answer the end bit of that about whether she had a happy life, I think, because I think it was impossible to ignore this in this particular story, Jared, the trauma. You know, you don't go looking for it with Madeline. It's obviously there. I think that she should have moved on. You know, I sort of look at it and think, why didn't she get her act together? Why couldn't she accommodate what had happened to her in childhood into a broader picture of it? And I think that's what her friends felt towards the end, that that she was stuck emotionally to some extent as that 12-year-old with what everyone acknowledges was a deeply traumatic event. So I think that you're partly right. I think she was actually towards the end of her life, by the time she published the books and she had a sort of sense of herself as an author. She wasn't so worried about the celebrity, but you know, to be a published author in the St. John clan was a huge thing, because they did value, you know, books and writing. They valued the arts. They valued academic achievement. They valued all achievement, and so that was a very important thing to her. So I think she was very much happier then. And I think she'd, in her own way, she'd, I think, at least it partially, as we all do as we get a bit older, come to terms with some aspects of her life. I think the hatred, well, hatred, I suppose, is the sort of love-hate relationship, feelings that she had for Ted all the way through really did inhibit her from having, being the best person that she could have been, for sure.
So we've got a question here and then here. Yep. Just speak up a bit, Lou, won't
it? I look forward to reading your book. Could I just ask you something about the Women in Black, which is the only one of her novels I've read, the one that's readily available.
Yes.
Which I think is a delightful novel. I was wondering if in your work you looked at how it was received in Australia when it first came out.
I did a little bit, but there's not much on the record about how it was received. There's not a lot of, it wasn't actually published here. It was distributed here. And I know Colette, went looking for copies and couldn't find them. I think her immediate family make references here and there in the letters, about loving it and receiving copies. It didn't make a big splash. I mean, the great thing about Madeline, about that book now is that what happened, it's a lovely story very quickly, is Text Publishing, which published my book and also is republishing her books. Michael Hayward's wife, Penny Houston, who is part of Text as well, is in a book club in Melbourne. One day she went to book club in about 2009 or something, and one of the other people said, "Oh, I found this fabulous book on the second-hand bookshop, The Women in Black. We ought to read it. It's wonderful." So they all read it and discussed it at book club. So Penny goes back to the office and says to Michael, "This is a great book. We should be publishing this." And Michael, in fact, did, and he did in 2009, 2010. Republished all four of those books. So all four of her novels have been republished. And then what happened is that accidentally I read one of them, and it is totally accidental because Peter Craven had done a review of one of the English ones, and I read it and thought, oh, I might have a look at that. And I did. And then once I read it and I thought, I'm going to do the biography, recklessly perhaps, I thought, well, really, let's be realistic here. The person who's going to publish it is Text. They know about her. Mm. So I went to Michael, and within about 3 or 4 months, I had managed to convince him, because, he needed to be convinced even, but he then loved the idea of it. And, of course, it's now fed into an opportunity for them to republish again the books. And when you say they're not available, in fact, they have been available, but they're probably in short supply, but the essence of the thing is coming out in July, I think, and then the other two, so they're this is a second republishing, basically, in the space. But anyhow, the point about it is, Women in Black, which was republished for the first time in 2009 or in Australia, has sold about 18 months or 2 years ago, Michael said it had sold about 40,000 copies, which is remarkable for for a dead author, effectively, who can't promote it. And since the republishing and since this book, I'd say it might have, it's doing very much better. And but the point about it is her books are almost like, it's almost like they're being published for the first time, because they're not particularly known. Although every now and then you meet someone, they've said, oh, I love Madeline Syndrome, and they've been reading her since the 90s and they've read them.
Question here?
Yes. I'm just a bit confused that she did the tapes because she wanted to.
Yeah. She did the tapes specifically to be sure she wanted her biography told. So what she did is she had an old friend, Judith McHugh, who lived she's an Australian Judith, but she happened to live in Chicago. They knew each other in London, then she goes to Chicago, and she used to visit all the time. So Madeline's in her flat, more or less confined with emphysema, unable to get out very much at all. So she basically puts a hard word on Judith to go over to Notting Hill in 2004 and record this, her life. And she says that she wants to be the biographer, and she wants Judith to write the biography. So Judith took those tapes back home. A couple of years later, Madeline died. Judith didn't really want to do anything with them. And then I found Judith by a roundabout route, because when I started doing the book, I thought, I've got to find people. And I looked at one of the books, The Essence of the Thing, is dedicated to Judith McHugh. Mm-hmm. And I thought, who is she? No one knows, blah, blah, blah. So I went on the net. Within about 5 minutes, I found her, because that's what the internet does these days. And I rang her up in Chicago, and I said, are you the, blah, blah? And she said, yes. And she said, had a little bit of a chat. Then she said, and by the way, I've got these tapes. And I thought, oh, that's terribly useful. So that's how they emerged. But Madeline, she didn't want to. I think Judith had heard the stories for years, and she was well and truly sick of Madeline's depiction of her life, to be honest. And I think, you know, I think she felt exhausted by the thought of it, you know. And also the tapes don't make a story, you know, you can't just do the biography. The tapes end in, the tapes go through real detail of all her childhood and all the dreadful things Ted did, all the dreadful things Val did, and they end in about 1968. Mm-hmm. But as someone said to me today, because I've been trying to get Radio National, you know, Hindsight, to do a program, and I was speaking, you know, to one of the producer and who's been looking at the tapes, and they're fantastic. But she said, you know, all the missed opportunity on those tapes, there's nothing about the years that she spent at Stanford, you know, really. There's nothing with Chris Tillam, there's nothing about London. It's just like it's all about this, you know, father. So they're only partially useful for a biography, but of course, sorry.
Hang on. Okay,
so
we go down the back and we come here. Yeah. You need to speak up because we won't get you in the iPod.
Do you think without the central obsession she would have been a novelist?
Oh, well, exactly. I think that's an interesting question. And, of course, the thing about the novels is that they're deep, but they're not dark, you know, so there's none of the... They're not an obvious reflection of the kind of life or, you know, her emotional life. So they're different. So in a way, you know, you could argue they're the escape, you know, particularly the Australian one. She paints Australia in the 60s, you know, the period when she was here as a teenager, in a far more optimistic, positive light, in some ways, in The Women in Black, than her own life would suggest. So, yeah, and I don't even now want to go into too much psychological analysis of it, you know, mainly because I think I've tried to let it, in this book, let the sort of some of the details speak for itself. But I think it is interesting. I think she certainly couldn't write those books until she was quite old. You know, I mean, she tried for about 20 years, up until, you know, all through the 70s and the 80s, to write a biography. Shows you how hard it is to write a biography. She was writing the biography of a woman called Helena Blavatsky, who's the founder of the Theosophical Society. And she struggled with it, and, you know, it became a running joke in the family, and this is what she was doing while she was sort of on unemployment benefits or these little jobs. Anyway, in the end, she tore that up, so we don't know whether it was, you know, good or bad. But it was then that she turned, probably she was about 48, 49, and she turned and wrote these books fairly quickly. So she'd had them rolling around in her head for a while, I suppose. But, yeah, I think it's impossible to know, you know, what leads to something else, but it's not a bad thesis, or the one you suggested.
Question here, then we'll get on.
Just getting back to the tapes. You listened to the tapes, and what format did they take? Were they just ramblings, or were they question and answer?
They are not. They, you know, so Judith's got the mic, and Judith says, "Well, you know, tell me about this."
So she prompted her.
Yeah, she prompted her, but really, to be honest, they're mainly, you know, Judith is not a interviewer, she's not a journalist. You know, she tries occasionally. Poor Judith, who's a very smart, you know, very astute, you know, sophisticated woman, but she tried every now and then to sort of pull Madeline up and say, "But, you know, well, could that be true about this?" Or, and Madeline would just not entertain another view of anything. So Madeline came to that process with a complete... She wasn't using those tapes as therapy or trying to understand the process through it or examination of a life. It was about a very... She had been working around that story around in her head for 30 years. She put it down. She was unable to be moved on some of the key things. And, of course, Madeline, like all of us in this... Judith, like all of us in this room, when she said some of the things, would say, you know, "Do you really mean that? Do you really mean that he actually deliberately rejected you? You're a 12-year-old, you know, but of course Madeline can't entertain another version of it. Very quickly on that, I think it's interesting because Colette had very much, and I haven't talked about that much, very much the same view, slightly different, but still the younger sister had very similar view. Very much blamed Ted for Sylvette's death. And after I talked to Colette and after I looked at the psychiatric records, you know, which I've just mentioned before, I then, of course, it was Colette allowed me to see them as the last living, you know, relative. She had to give permission. So then Colette saw them all and we talked about them in detail. And a very different picture emerges of Sylvette, because it's clear that Sylvette had very deep depression for about 4 or 5 years, was an alcoholic, and that Ted was probably at his wit's end by the time Sylvette died. So, and Colette said to me, I just got to be careful how I put this exactly. Colette, I think Colette wanted at one level to really understand that this was a different picture, but I don't think that she has really shifted her position, if you can put it that way. I suppose what I'm trying to say, and maybe I shouldn't mention Colette in it, but I think would have been very difficult for Madeleine, even if she'd been told all this information about her mother at the end of her life, which she didn't know any of this. None of the records were ever known. None of the story about Sylvette's psychiatric illness was really exposed. I don't think Madeleine would have been able to sort of integrate that into the story that she'd carried around in her head for 50 years or so. And I think I had indications of that, I suppose, from Colette. And I think it is too hard. You know, it is, you know, if you're, you know, in your 60s and you have built a life and constructed a psyche almost, or you've managed to hold yourself together almost through very difficult times with a particular view of what had happened, I think it's kind of probably pretty difficult to turn around and sort of change it. So I suppose that's that question of the tapes. They're pretty... she had a pretty cut and dried view of what had happened. Yeah.
To me, the problem of the tapes, with so little else about her actual life, is to what extent did they kind of shape your biography in a kind of inaccurate direction?
Yeah.
I know you had to keep...
Yeah, understand. Yeah.
She obviously had a life. Mm. I mean, she obviously did something. She may have lived in poverty much of the time, but she obviously occupied herself.
Yeah.
She obviously had an affair. She obviously travelled the world, whatever. And then sort of in her 60s, she suddenly has this split the dummy about dad stuff.
Mm.
And that's all you've got that's really big.
On the record,
So how much time do you spend trying to chuck that aside and trying to find the real Madeleine? Yeah. Because, you know, in our brains, we can turn ourselves into all kinds of monsters, but that's not what other people see. So other people do talk to, how much have they shared a lot of that sort of dark fantasy.
I know exactly what you mean, and I think it's sometimes when I look back on the 2 years of research, I can't remember what I learned when, and it was all very clear at the time. And now you look back and you remember that at that time, you know, when I went to listen to the tapes in Chicago and had this sort of onslaught over several days listening to them with Judith, I hadn't talked to as many people as I talked to, obviously, 18 months later. And of course, you go back and look at the tapes again, but in some ways, it is set in cement in your mind, and some of these things are hard to move. I suppose, precisely on the question, I think in the end, the tapes, when I talk about it and the story, they sort of dominate it. But I don't actually think they dominate the book, to be honest, because there is a lot of other material in there about the time in London. And some, in fact, towards the end of the process, I thought, oh, have I used enough of the tapes? You know, like, because in many ways, I didn't quote as much as I thought I would from the tapes because they are repetitive and only from a slice of her life. And so I gained a lot from letters in the end too, because what happened towards the end of the process, it was good. First of all, Colette's memories were quite good about childhood, and I hadn't had some of those. I started even talking to people like, you know, Des Hunter, who I mentioned, but also letters, because Chris Tillam had, you know, one of the big problems I had even, you know, 9 months ago or something, I suppose, you know, was that I didn't have a lot about America. Chris Tillam hadn't talked to me. None of her friends knew anything about what they'd done in America because they'd gone there for 3 or 4 years because Chris had won a scholarship to Stanford and then they'd gone to Harvard and he was a filmmaker and they worked there, etc. So I actually had to piece that together. I had to find his faculty, you know, friends and everything, and I did piece a lot of it together, find friends in Harvard and try to get them to talk about what she was like. So I'd done that story. Then Chris came to agree to talk to me, and that was very useful for the time. You know, he knew Madeleine for about 10 years from university till the end, and of course that was fantastic, changed it all. But also he gave me about 40 letters from Madeleine. Madeleine, when they were in America, wrote a lot to Chris's mother, because they were very close, Joan Tillam, back in Australia. And Joan had kept all those letters, even after the divorce, obviously, and kept them very much. And Chris kept them after Joan died. And then he allowed me to sort of use them, and some of his letters as well. So that ended up being a very much richer view, I suppose, of Madeleine at that period when she was rather brighter and happier, at least in the letters. In reality, she wasn't, but that was her facade. So I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting point. Sometimes I'm sure that, to some extent, every biography is biased about what you actually have, because what you haven't got.
Just quickly, before we go to Dan Saunders, you said the correspondence had been destroyed, some of it, between her and her family.
Yeah.
Was that at both ends or just at the father and stepmother's end?
At both ends. Effectively, what happened was there's a lot of dispute, you know, probably sort of the 90s when it got quite bitter before and after Ted's death about the will and various things. And Madeline demanded some letters back from Valerie, and Valerie didn't send them back. She sent a couple back. And then, so there they were. Madeline died in 2004, and she actually said in her will that she wanted all the letters destroyed. And Val talked to one of her sons and actually did destroy them, which is rather depressing. But a couple of them she'd sent back. Madeline, certainly, the material from Madeline in terms of letters are, there's a couple of letters from Val explaining things about the will, and there's an exchange in a particular period of time when they were battling over the will, but there's nothing else. Madeline did not keep letters from other people. She did, they're not, I haven't got them, so.
Jan.
I was just
going to
say, I worked for Ted in the Yes.
When he was an QC?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was pretty much estranged from both the girls, and I was I didn't meet Madeline, but I had a bit to do with Colette. Do you know if Colette ever had a relationship, ended up having a relationship with her parents? Or was she the same
with
as
Madeline? Yeah. Hers went on and off a fair bit, I think. Like, there were years when she was estranged from them and other years when they were together, because Colette had a son and who she had to bring up by herself here in Australia. And Val and Ted were pretty good to Erin, the steps, the grandchild. And so it went on and off. But I think, and of course, you know what happens is people don't want to admit afterwards how long they've been estranged. But I think by the time Ted died in 94, Colette was voluntarily estranged. But she went, but she got back in contact with Valerie. And she said to me, Colette, in 2011, Val died in 2010, so she hadn't been long deceased when I spoke to Colette for the first time, and she said that by the end of her stepmother's life, she understood her stepmother and she valued her. That had a much closer relationship. Mm-hmm. They were much more friendly, and Val was being. They were sort of reunited, but it has been a pretty up and down affair, and the siblings really haven't had much to do with each other in recent times. And it was not quite as shattered, I suppose, as a relationship Madeline had with Val and Ted, but Colette's relationship wasn't.
Now we're going to end up with two quick questions. We're going to end up with Hilary and Penelope. Okay.
I just wanted to, did anyone have a happy life? And they were Valerie and Ted happy?
Yes, I think.
Did they have any children other than the girls?
Yeah, well, that's actually a really good point, because they had. So the two girls are Sylvette and Ted's children, and then in 1954, Sylvette suicided. End of 1955, Ted remarried Val St. John, who was about 10 years younger. She was about 27 when she married. And they had three sons, Oliver, who I've mentioned, who is sadly disabled, so I didn't talk to him for the book. And then two other sons, one's about 52 and one's about 50. Ed's St. John, he calls himself now. Ed St. John, and Patrick St. John, both of whom were fantastic help to me and were great. And they had a very happy life with their father. They certainly did. And Colette too said to me that Val had been a fabulous mother. She didn't think she was a good stepmother, but she thought she was a fabulous mother, done a wonderful job with the boys. And they seem to have had a good time. They clearly didn't have as close a relationship with their father as they might have had with their mother. He's a little tiny bit remote, but they were it was very interesting, actually, because both of them said to me separately when I began to research it, they were sort of happy about it, and they gave me permission to use letters and, copyright and things like that, and talked about what they knew about it. But they were both quite interested in me doing the biography so they could find out more about Ted's life before they were born, because they said he obviously had another life at Castle Crag and at Merriula, the arts colony here, and a different exotic bohemian life with Sylvette, which, of course, was completely closed off for them. So in a sense, it was this amazing situation where you think you're learning more about them than they know themselves. But yes, to be fair to both, absolutely fair to both Ted and Val, I think they had a happy marriage too. Yes, they had a happy. They had a very happy time. And Val, I think, initially would have been in Ted's thrall a bit, but I understand by the end of the marriage might have been reversed, because Ted was very much took her view on things and things like that. So anyway,
Final question, Penelope.
In the book, you say that Madeleine stayed in England partly because it was as far away as you can get from Ted. But when I read the book and I see this kind of distressed Edwardian gentlewoman persona that she affected, perhaps England was offering her a kind of retreat into Bloomsbury or the past that we couldn't offer her here. And she started writing like Ivy Compton Burnett. Do you think she was kind of nostalgic for an earlier era?
I agree. It was almost out of her time a little bit, is what you're suggesting. Yeah. I think so. I think at some level she was very modern. You know, she was, one of her friends said, she's a real rock chick in the 70s. You know, she was a groupie, really, with this Australian band that had a huge success for about 5 minutes called Quintessence. You know, it's rather remarkable. You go into the net now and there's all this material about Quintessence, you know. But anyway, so she was quite up to date, you know, in that sense. She wasn't in her 30s, I suppose, really trying to be oldie-worldie. But I think, yes, I think she hungered later on for a sort of an England that was disappearing. I think she loved, like, she went back to the church. She was obviously a cultural Anglican and her family is very much Church of England, but she went back to the church and I think it was because it reminded her that was England, you know, that was part of being English, part of being in England and being in London. So I don't know that... I might have said in the book that she's as far away from London, from Ted, but I'm not sure that I did, because I think she went to London because she thought that was home. She, one of her agents, Sarah Lutchins, who's English, said to me at one stage, she said, don't make the mistake of thinking that she was sort of part of the diaspora. She didn't think of herself as part of the Australian diaspora. She thought the lost years were the years that family spent in Australia. She was returning to France and, you know, her maternal roots, in a sense, with Sylvette, to France, and even to the Anglican part of it, I suppose, the St. John part of it, the English part of it. So she didn't consider, certainly when she left and when she hung on for so long in England without jobs, without really a life, a, you know, big life, and it was because I think she... wanted to, she thought that was more her thing. I think when she came back to Australia, she mellowed a little bit about Australia towards the end, because one of her carers said to me, and this was, you know, a couple of years before she died, her carer said she used to talk about Australia, and not with anger towards the end, but she still seemed unbelievably French, you know, not at all Australian.
Helen, many thanks.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.